It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look into a bright future for agriculture as young people join the ranks of small-scale farming.
First, a new report by the state's Department of Revenue predicts that Wisconsin could see about 40,000 new jobs in 2014. It also projects over 34,000 jobs we added in 2015.
While some see this as good news, others point out that it still leaves Wisconsin well short of Governor Walker's 250,000 job pledge, which he made 4 years ago.
Brian Jacobson is with us to help make sense of these numbers and what they mean for Wisconsin's economic future. He's an associate professor of business administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College and chief portfolio strategist at Wells Fargo Advantage Funds. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So looking at federal numbers, the state's added over 90,000 jobs in the last few years, 44,000 more projected to be added. But help us make sense of that. When we hear numbers like this, is this good news? Is this less than we'd want? Where do you see that?
Well, you know, when it comes to the Wisconsin jobs numbers, I think that we have to put things into perspective, not only relative to which industries are growing, adding the jobs, but then also relative to not just the nation, but surrounding states as far as kind of the benchmark how we're doing. And Wisconsin job growth has been lagging, unfortunately. And if you actually look at some of the projections that were put out by the government lately as part of their Wisconsin economic outlook, it looks like job growth is going to likely to continue, but at a slightly slower pace. So it's not exactly all that bad, but it's not great. And one of the problems with some of these forecasts, too, is the only thing that economists are worse at forecasting than the economy is the weather. So you always have to take a lot of these forecasts with a grain of salt.
Right, because there could be a national or even international economic climate change that could really skew those projections, right?
That's right. You never know. And that's one of the things that hit the U.S. economy overall, especially Wisconsin at the beginning of last year, towards the end of last year, if you will, as far as with the very miserable winter weather that we had. It was a real damper on economic activity in general. So those are some of the outside things that can affect some of these outlooks. Now, when you're looking at why is it that the government's creating some of these forecasts, a lot of it is for budgetary reasons. You know, they have to draft a budget, and a big component of that is income taxes as to what's going to be collected, since personal income taxes make up more than half of Wisconsin state budget. It's important to sort of have a baseline reading for what sort of growth you can expect from there. And that's where, when I look at some of the projections, I'm a little skeptical about whether or not we're going to see the robust growth that's sort of built in there. It's anywhere from 4 to 4.5% growth in incomes. And income growth in Wisconsin has been lagging even more so than what job growth has been.
And that same report predicted an increase in personal income. It's expected to grow by 3.1% this year, a little over 4%. They're guessing, hoping next year. So what do you make of those changes? Are you skeptical that it's going to even reach that level of income growth?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a real challenge, is to reach that 4% income growth level. Just within the environment that we're in, it's not as though we're in sort of the real rapid phase of the economic cycle as far as rebounding from the recession. And so I find it a little difficult to believe that we're going to see accelerating income growth. But, you know, it is quite possible when you break it out by income source. Keep in mind, when it comes to personal income, only about half of that is from wages and compensation. Others come from, say, dividend income, interest income, rental income, transfers from various government programs and the such. A lot of the income growth is going to be closer to about the 3% pace, which seems pretty reasonable. So, I mean, in general, a lot of these projections, they seem very reasonable, maybe mildly optimistic, but nothing that's really all that outlandish.
Now, projection that we're going to hit our pre-recession employment peak in the middle of next year, later than the rest of the country, but also, as I understand it, we kind of felt the recession later than the rest of the country. Why are we lagging on both ends of the recession?
Well, that's actually somewhat unique, because usually Wisconsin seems to be first in and last out, as opposed to last in and last out. And I think that one of the big reasons for it is just that we've had such tepid growth in employment, and it could be for any variety of reasons. People like to point to the fact that, you know, Wisconsin is a manufacturing economy, but in fact, the biggest employer as far as economic sector is more on the trade, transportation, utility side. Manufacturing isn't the number one one employer in Wisconsin. And manufacturing has made a decent comeback, but it hasn't necessarily been in the specific categories of manufacturing items. You know, if you think about the Wisconsin economy, agriculture has done very well lately, but it's not a huge part of the economy. So there's been a lot of bright spots, but they've been in such small parts of the economy that it hasn't really moved the needle for the overall economy. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons for it. There's a lot of bright spots. It's just not enough to make it really this glaring light.
I don't know if you noticed, but we just had an election here, and a big issue in that election was the economy and job creation, and a lot of argument. What did the Doyle administration do to affect the job market, the Walker administration? What would a now non-existent Burke administration do? But how much of this is really in the hands of a governor and of state policy?
Oh, very little. You know, a lot of it can be said as far as what's the specific policies that are in place, you know, the tax environment, the regulatory environment, that sort of thing. But, you know, at a state level, so much of it is determined by forces outside of the state that a governor can only make so much of a contribution. I mean, it's almost impossible to quantify it. But if you think about what the governor can do, he has to work with a legislature. And then it takes time for a lot of these programs to be put into place that some of the issues facing Wisconsin are decades in the making. So it's somewhat unreasonable to assume that a governor or a specific administration is going to just be able to turn the entire ship around or sink the entire ship.
Now, a dream of a lot of states or regions or communities is to have the local equivalent of Silicon Valley or a Wall Street or something that brings together a whole lot of cash, a whole lot of businesses and innovation. There was talk in Wisconsin some years ago about a biotech alley stretching from Madison to Milwaukee and into rural regions. Do we have anything like that on the horizon, some kind of new economy sector that we can pin our hopes on?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of areas of possibility. Obviously, the research university, so the University of Wisconsin-Madison and also Milwaukee, both of them do tremendous amounts of research, and there's great opportunity there for who knows what the next development is going to be. Is it going to be in the biotech area? Is it going to be with genetic research? Is it going to be with clean water? You know, I mean, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has made some very good investments in the area of water economics and with water purification. And all sorts of different areas. There's also been a number of people coming from Wisconsin that are on the international stage now. If you think about the head of Microsoft, the head of Yahoo, they are people who are from Wisconsin. So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of possibility. It's just a question of how much can you create an environment in which those individuals can really thrive. I don't think that government policy can necessarily force those things to form. I know that every municipality probably wants to have its form of, as you said, Silicon Valley. But can you really artificially create that, or does it just have to sort of arise organically? I tend to believe that it has to arise organically because, unfortunately, we've seen too often people throwing a lot of resources, a lot of money behind creating these clusters, and they just really don't work.
One issue we've heard, including from Morris Davis at the business school here, is a worry about brain drain. When we have young educated people who might be creating these businesses, these clusters, they look around Wisconsin, they don't see an attractive lifestyle, they go somewhere else with a business climate they can fit into and with a lifestyle they can fit into. Do we have hopes of competing with the regions they're going to?
I think so. You know, if you, I mean, for one thing, you still have a lot of people who are staying behind. Some people like this type of weather. Some people like the proximity to family. And that's actually one of the bigger determinations about where people actually move to is where's their family. And so if you continue to have an environment in which you have people, you know, that's conducive to starting a family and raising a family, you know, with the good schools, with the decent infrastructure, I think that that's pretty much all you can do. We can't do much to really change the weather. I mean, we're not going to compete with San Diego or San Jose on that basis. So you just have to make sure that you have policies in place that are going to make it easy for people who like this type of environment to stay.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Brian Jacobson. He's Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College, and he's Chief Portfolio Strategist at Wells Fargo Advantage Funds, getting us caught up on a new job creation report released by the state's Department of Revenue.
Our next guest says the future of small-scale farming might be looking up. The number of new farmers is showing growth.
The most recent agricultural census shows that between 2007 and 2012, the number of young beginning farmers increased nearly 12%. And with the age of the average farmer at 58, new farmers are needed to keep joining the ranks.
Writer Lauren Markham joins us now. She writes about the rise of young small-scale farmers in the latest issue of Orion Magazine. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why do more young people seem to be moving towards small-scale farming right now?
It's a great question, and that's sort of what I was seeking to answer when I set out to write this article. A big part of it is, from what I found, is that young people are increasingly taking up environmentalism as the sort of main activist endeavor of our times. And increasingly, as we sort of look at Washington and sort of see what's happening in Washington, you know, in the advertisement of your show, they were just talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. There seems to be more and more environmental catastrophes happening all around us, and legislation, activism through government, isn't necessarily shifting things or changing things very well. And so a lot more young people are choosing to become farmers because it's this sort of environmental activism at their own hands. It's something that they can change by doing something themselves instead of waiting for Congress to step up.
That's a switch from, you know, what you might expect to hear about why farmers farm. You might expect that they enjoy working the land and the reward of being outside, working physically, working with animals. You're saying it's largely a form of activism.
Yeah, I would actually say it's really both. I think, and I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's also a lifestyle choice. I think that, you know, our generation, I'm 31, our generation is very much a tech generation. And with the increase in technology comes this like insane kind of grind. And I think that farming is sort of a rejection of that and a sort of this retreat back to a more natural kind of rhythm. And working the land is a really important part of that. So it's certainly a lifestyle choice, but it's also a lifestyle choice that's imbued with this environmentalism, this activism, this sense that, you know, these young farmers want to be doing something that supports the world around them, that makes their world a better place.
Can you give us a snapshot of one or two of the young farmers that you met?
Yeah, absolutely. So two of the farmers I profiled are Dina Miller and Robbie Martin, and they're a couple. They actually met at a farming program in UC Santa Cruz, and they're farming some of Dina's family's land in Grass Valley in California. Their farm is beautiful. They have dozens and dozens of varieties, and they're selling their produce to local co-ops. They've started CSAs, and they're really trying to work the natural rhythms of the land and grow what is, you know, healthy for the land. So it's not just about them growing their crops for to feed others and for their own gain, but also to kind of replenish the land and be kind of stewards of the land that they're working on.
Do you have a sense of how this is playing out here in Wisconsin as you see across the country, young people moving into small-scale farming? Is that happening in Wisconsin as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I should say that I'm not an expert about what's happening in Wisconsin, but the Land Stewardship Project is funding something called the Farm Beginnings Program, which provides training throughout Wisconsin, I think particularly central Wisconsin, for new farmers. And there are some really exciting initiatives that grads of the Farm Beginnings Program are launching throughout the state. There's a food marketing co-op for sustainable agriculture, I think, in the north. So, I mean, I would say that in almost every state that this sort of movement is taking root.
You say that there's almost this hip edge to it, that you know people who call them farmsters, a mashup of the words hipster and farmer. How big a part of it is that?
I think it is a big part. This actually didn't make it into the piece, but just for length purposes. But several of the farmers I talked to talked about how, you know, because there's this movement happening and it's sort of happening kind of in concert with a sort of national foodie movement where there's this, you know, farm-to-table consciousness and this idea that, you know, oh, you know, fancy food and where our food comes from. Fancy food and farms are sort of one and the same, which sort of was not how it always was. And I think that a lot of the farmers I spoke to were saying that partially because of that, now when they say, hey, I'm a farmer, people are like, wow, that's so cool, that's so interesting, that's amazing, where and their families are much more supportive, whereas, you know, 2 decades ago, would that have been the case? They really feel like maybe not, that that increasingly the kind of hip nature of farming and of food is creating a pathway for young people to engage in that and to be sort of regarded regarded as just being like a very positive and cool thing to do.
Now, farming, whether it's this new iteration of farming with young people, just through the ages, farming has been known as a difficult profession. You get up early, you work hard, it's backbreaking labor. Are there things now that might mitigate some of the things that were tougher when farmers, you know, were farming in the past decades or even centuries ago? Things like isolation and crop failure, to deal with things like that and the hard work itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the hard work is just the hard work. And that was, you know, I sort of opened my piece with talking about how spring is the hardest time of year, which is something I didn't know, that it's like when everything's coming up, it's before the bounty of the summer, it's when you're seeing all of the failures, it's like all this backbreaking work. And I think that the fact is you're waking up early, by the hour you're making almost no money. You know, no matter how hard you're working with nature, and so there are all of these unforeseen challenges, like early frost, or you know, or bugs or pests that you can't kind of necessarily anticipate. And so I think the backbreaking nature of the work is just is just how it is. But I do think that something that I wrote about is that increasingly, as this becomes a more normative thing for younger people to go into, and actually with technology. There's more of a kind of connective tissue among farmers, that there are more resources out there. It's easier to get information and to share resources and to sort of share the glory and the pain among various farmers, honestly, through connections via the internet.
And you write about a group called the Greenhorns. What are they?
The Greenhorns are fantastic. They're a group. They're basically what I just described. They're a group that's promoting young beginning farmers, largely young farmers, but just new farmers in general. And they're doing that through publishing books and also creating internet platforms for farmers for young and beginning farmers to share information, to share best practices, so that not every new farmer is completely reinventing the wheel. And there's this sort of sense of community, even if, you know, I'm in northern Wisconsin and you're in, you know, the Central Valley of California and someone else is in Vermont, that we can all actually be sharing our experiences and our expertise as we sort of grow into this profession.
This can sound a little like the back to the land movement in the 60s, a lot of people wanting to get out of the workaday grind and to work the land, do something that they feel is more meaningful. How is this different than that movement?
That was a question that I had, and I asked Severin von Scharzer Fleming of the Greenhorns, and she said, oh, you know, and I thought it was like this really, you know, smart question. She said, oh, I've been asked that question a million times. And she says, look, with the back to the landers, they were often going into the woods and farming not as great land. They had more access to land, though, and we don't. There's not, you know, land is astronomically expensive these days, and it's way harder for young farmers you know, to access land and that land capital. However, because of the internet and because of this sort of foodie movement and this interest in organic food and in local food, there's more of a market for this. And through the, you know, emergence of CSAs, and, you know, I live in Berkeley, California, and my CSA is 3 hours away, but I get that CSA. Like, because of the internet, we're able to, there's a better market for these young farmers to sell their wares.
How important are these farmers, do you think, these young farmers, to the future of farming?
I came away feeling incredibly optimistic. I think they're very important to the future of farming. I'm not an agricultural expert, but from my vantage point, I think there's sort of an inherent optimism imbued in becoming a farmer and choosing to become a farmer. You know, I don't think that anytime soon, these beginning farmers are going to thwart the entire massive agricultural industry that exists in the United States or around the world. But I do think that in their small plots of land, they're restoring the natural rhythms of the earth. They're reinvigorating ancient practices, ancient agricultural practices that are much more safe for and better for the earth. And I think that, you know, little by little, there's a movement happening, and that was really heartening to see.
with the Back to the Landers in the 60s, a lot of those folks ended up being a little disillusioned. The work was hard. The life was hard. The money was hard. And so a lot of them left for more comfortable lifestyles in the city, for instance. How do you see this playing out here? Do you think anything's different enough that these are farmers who are going to be around for a generation or two?
You know, most of the farmers that I spoke to feel as though that this is their vocation. Whether they stay on this farm or whether they, you know, like I, one of the folks that I wrote about, he's a sheep farmer and he's gone into a range management master's program at Berkeley. So he has left farming now to pursue higher education, but higher education that's related to farming. So my impression is that whether they're actually owning and operating their own farms far into the future, I think that's a lot of their goals, but whether they're doing that or not, this agricultural and environmental ethic is sort of sticking with them, and they're going to be involved in agriculture in some way.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Writer Lauren Markham writes about the rise of young, small-scale farmers in the latest issue of Orion magazine. She's also a contributor to The New Republic and This American Life. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. What exactly is a living wage here in Wisconsin? The state and the nation are in the middle of an ongoing conversation about raising the minimum wage. 10 states and the District of Columbia raised their minimum wages during the last legislative season. Some cities did, too, with Seattle phasing in a $15 minimum wage that makes it the highest in the nation.
Here in Wisconsin, labor advocates are suing the Walker administration to get the state to evaluate whether or not Wisconsin's minimum wage of $7.25 is a living wage. Wisconsin has a century-old living wage clause that says the base wage should not be below a living wage.
And voters from both parties and counties around the state indicated that they'd like to see the state's minimum wage raised to $10.10 an hour in advisory referenda during midterm elections.
So if some Wisconsinites say $7.25 an hour is not a living wage, then what is? Today we ask you just that. Call us now at 800-642-1234. We'd love to know, based on your experiences, your own wages or salary, the cost of things where you live, what is a living wage in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Here with us to kick off the conversation is Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Stephen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with our terminology, a living wage. How do you define it?
Well, depends which economist you ask. You'll get a different answer. Basically, it is it's a wage level that you can essentially pay your bills. You can live in a reasonably priced house or apartment. You can afford to eat nutritiously, and you can basically cover your costs.
Now, as I understand it, legally in Wisconsin, living wage is also defined under the law as one providing a worker with, this is a quote, reasonable comfort, reasonable physical well-being, decency, and moral well-being. So different terminology there, and I expect that there's a lot of gray area when you define it.
There is a lot of gray area. I mean, because essentially what we're saying is that we want to have a wage structure that people are comfortable. Now, comfort is, I mean, everybody's going to have a different definition of what is a comfortable wage. Some folks, you could be six figures and you're still not comfortable. Other folks could be, $10 an hour and I'm doing fine, thank you very much.
So how would you say you generally calculate a living wage?
There's many ways of doing it. I think that a simple way to do it is, suppose that you're looking at buying a house. And what does the banker usually say? Well, you shouldn't spend more than 30 to 33% of your income on a house, on living. So we could use that as kind of a benchmark and work backwards and say, well, what would it take to pay for an apartment that is $500 a month? And you work it backwards and you assume, well, 38-hour work week, 4 weeks out of a month, and that's a little over $10 an hour. I've done a little calculation based on weight or rents in Wisconsin counties, and the county with the lowest rent for an apartment is Forest County, and using that 30% rule, you're looking at a wage of about $9.90. The most expensive is Waukesha County, and there you're looking at $19.87 an hour. So it really varies by location.
So how would the government, say, account for that variation if they were theoretically interested in pursuing a living wage when there's such variation?
Well, there's different ways of doing it. The one way is to increase the minimum wage to some threshold. The question is that how do you adjust that for cost of living? And unfortunately, we really don't have very good data on that. I mean, the best that we've got really is kind of housing prices. And median rent is a pretty good proxy for cost of living. So you could do it on that, but then it's going to create, it could create a lot of confusion, a lot of misunderstanding. Another way to do it might be through the tax code, and to establish something like a state-level earned income tax credit, where rather than actually going out and forcing employers to pay more, is essentially use the tax code to achieve the same end.
We've got a caller. Let's go to Wade in Black River Falls, and you can join us as well. What is your definition of a living wage? What do you need to live on, to pay your rent, to take care of the kids, to buy groceries? What constitutes a comfortable living wage to you? That's our discussion right now. Wade, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, thanks for putting me on. The problem in many cases is not just the minimum wage, but the number of hours that a person's able to work. They've been limited to working under 30 hours because I'm going to use QSRs, quick service restaurants. They're limited to 30 hours because of the benefits situation with the Quality Care Act. So by raising the minimum wage, people have already lost roughly 10 hours a week. So the larger question is can we get them back to working more hours at the lesser pay to keep the cost for the actual employer better? They've really taken the money out of a person's pocket because they don't get the hours anymore. And I also find that more people are less likely to work two jobs to make up for the difference.
Okay, thanks a lot, Wade. And Wade, getting at the fact, I guess, that a lot of people don't work 40 hours a week. Some people are, in fact, constrained to keep it to 30. How does that factor in here?
That's another complicating factor. Different businesses will have maximum number of hours that they can work for a variety of reasons that they can do that. That's why we have a growing pool of folks that are kind of forced to work multiple part-time jobs. They may appear to be full-time employed, but because they're really kind of jockeying three different jobs in order to make ends meet, it really creates a hardship for a lot of these folks.
Now, when we look at the proposed minimum wage that, for instance, Mary Burke was supporting in her candidacy, $10.10, there's a discrepancy between that, say, and what some calculations for the living wage are from MIT. Say if you're an adult, you have one child, they calculate a living wage, in that case, at $19.95 an hour. So maybe a $10 break there. How do you account for some of the different numbers here?
One of the biggest is out-of-pocket expenditures. When you look at that MIT study, the big difference when you look about different types of households is childcare. You end up with a lot of folks that are working at minimum wage jobs, and they have to provide for child care, whether that's preschool child care or after-school child care. And when you figure that in, you have to make a lot more, because not only do you need to cover the cost of the child care, but you still have to be able to afford to pay rent and put food on the table. And it becomes very, very difficult for a lot of families to be able to do that.
Right. It's interesting looking at the same MIT calculations. One adult with two children in child care, the cost there upwards of $1,000, $1,233 a month. So child care, definitely something under consideration here for the living wage. Let's go next to Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Interesting program. I think your guest does a great job of articulating this. I think the question about a minimum or a living wage is really dependent on the person themselves. I mean, I was telling your screener that when my wife and I were first married. I lived in Oklahoma in the mid 80s, and the minimum wage then was $4 an hour, and we lived on it. Lived in a 2-bedroom apartment, pretty minuscule living. So it's kind of a tough question to ask, because it really depends. In an American entitlement society, some people living wage is eating caviar and driving a Cadillac. I mean, that would be some people. So I just don't like that terminology of living wage. I think it's somewhat, because a living wage in Wisconsin is different than a living wage in New York City.
Right.
And
Tim, I'm curious about the age factoring in, too. You said, I think when you were in college, you lived on $4 an hour. Do you think as people get older, they maybe come to expect a different standard of living, and therefore the living wage idea would increase over time?
Well, I think one of the problems you have in this society is you have people fresh out of college, and they think they should be living at the lifestyle their parents live at when it took them 40 years to get there. I mean, come on. I mean, the factor is when you're first married and you're starting out, I don't think you should expect the same, you know, this kind of idea that, well, I should be making $50 an hour and living high off the hog. I think one of the problems with Americans is they live in a debt society, and people don't want to live without anything, so they go way in debt, and then they're trying to pay their bills off. And there is some aspect you almost have to do that today, but you also have to learn to live within your means, and that has become a lost art in American society today. So,
okay, thank you for your thoughts, Tim. I appreciate that. Do you think, Stephen, that there is some point, from an economic standpoint, below which it's impossible, though, to do the basic things, shelter, food?
Yeah, there is, and that's kind of what the living wage concept is supposed to be, is that you've got basically reasonable housing that you can afford to eat, that you can afford basic transportation to get to work, that you can cover the necessities of life, if you will. But the caller's correct. I mean, Tim is perfectly correct in saying that different people, you know, the necessities of life, well, is that a brand new car? Is that a state-of-the-art stereo system? Or is it simply, you know, I want to be able to live in a safe neighborhood, and that's my criteria. And it's going to vary from person to person. It's also going to vary by the type of place that you live. If there's a fair amount of research out there that says that some folks are willing to take a lower wage to live in a really nice place. Some people have referred to that as the Madison effect, if I could. Is that people are willing to take a lower wage to live in Madison because of the amenities that are here. The entertainment, the ability to different types of restaurants. There are other places, though, that I won't name them, that you'll have to pay me more to live there. So it gets to be a very complicated situation, and it's going to vary a lot from person to person.
We're speaking right now with Stephen Deller, Applied Economics Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The question we're considering is, what is a living wage in Wisconsin? Labor groups are arguing that the state's minimum wage should be raised by law because the state constitution requires that the base wage be a living wage.
So tell us what you think a living wage is here in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Based on your income and expenses, what pay rate do you think allows you to live comfortably, however you define that? And are you a business owner? What wages do you pay? Do you think those are living wages? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And to be clear, we're not asking on this conversation whether or not we should raise the minimum wage. We're asking what you think a living wage is. What does it take to pay the bills, provide for your family every month?
We're continuing our conversation about what a living wage is here in Wisconsin. There's been a national and statewide conversation about whether the minimum wage should be raised to a living wage. Labor advocates in the state are suing the Walker administration to reconsider whether the state minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a living wage.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 about what you think a living wage is in Wisconsin. From your life experience, what is the hourly wage someone needs to make to maintain a base level of comfort, health, safety, wellness? Were there times when you felt like you did make that living wage, other times you didn't? Share it with us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Steve, before we get to some of these callers, Why do we have, for instance, a minimum wage to get at this question of a living wage? Why a minimum wage?
It's essentially establishing a floor. It's just a phraseology to say that you can't pay below this. So there's nothing magic about a minimum wage or that particular terminology.
And do you see a case for essentially changing the terminology minimum wage to criteria for a living wage?
I think a minimum wage makes it cleaner. As soon as you start talking about a living wage, it becomes much more complicated. As we know, if we would, you know, today trying to pass any kind of policy is very difficult. So I think the cleaner and the simpler that we can make it, it's more likely to actually move forward.
And let's get to the state itself. Can you run us through what a living wage is here in Wisconsin?
Again, it really varies on what part of the state that you're living in. I mean, it can range all the way from, you know, $10 an hour in Forest County is a living wage, if you want to call it that, to $20 an hour in Waukesha County. So, I mean, it really varies by where you are. I can remember a friend in college, a bachelor's degree, coming out of Illinois, that was offered a wage at the Bank of Boston, and his base comparison was Illinois and central Illinois, rural Illinois. And looking at that wage that the Bank of Boston offered him, he thought, oh, geez, that's a really good wage. I could live pretty good as a single guy. Moved out to Boston, and he couldn't find an apartment. So, I mean, it really varies from place to place. I think that's why a minimum wage is essentially saying this is the bare minimum. And we're going to set that bare minimum and then let the market decide if we want to go above that.
Let's head back to our callers now. Tim joins us in Madison. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
I employ several hundred people in the food industry business, and we like to pay a living wage only because you get better employees and they stick around longer and get better customer service, and it's better for my bottom line to pay people more. So, I mean, your last two callers were, they seemed anti-living wage. So I think as a business owner, I make more money by paying my employees more.
So you wouldn't agree with the argument that has been made that if you're paying your employees more, you can't afford to hire as many employees?
That's utter nonsense. It's demand that creates, how many employees you need. And the better service you give, the better repeat customers you're going to have, the more business you're going to have, the more people you're going to have to hire.
And are you willing to share with us what you pay your workers?
Well, let's say we have hire a high school kid, $10 an hour. And starting cook, just starting, $11.18. So, and that's higher than the minimum wage. That's starting. Those are our starting wages. So,
okay. Well, thank you so much.
I think Tim raises a very good point here. Is how does a business move towards profitability? And there's kind of two broad approaches. Sometimes it's referred to as the high road versus the low road. The high road is the approach that Tim took, and essentially service matters, the quality of the product matters, and I'm willing to pay my workers whatever it takes to get that product quality and service to the highest level that I possibly can. That's kind of the high road. The other way is we're going to cut costs as much as we can. We're going to drive down labor costs. We're going to drive down input supply cost, and that results in much lower wage pages. I mean, so it's two different ways of how do we, as a company, how do we generate profits?
Okay. Well, thank you, Tim, for that call. We're going to move next to Craig in Green Bay. Hi, Craig.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I definitely kind of agree with that last caller. The around between $10 and $12 an hour, you can pay your bills. I think for a living wage, I'm 30 years old. I just went back to school. I think for a living wage to be able to pay your bills without help from your family, I think you would have to be closer to the $15 mark. And then the one caller who said earlier just about, you know, how a lot of people expect to graduate from college and then, you know, live this posh life and not have to put in the time, I have to disagree. I think a lot of people from, you know, an older generation don't quite understand where people that are just graduating are coming from, but it's, you have to look at the complete opposite spectrum of what it was like 30, 40 years ago, getting out of high school and getting a job at a local factory and basically being able to support and raise your family. I think anybody who graduates college now, they just want to be able to live a comfortable life and support their family like their grandparents did before them.
Thanks a lot for the call, Craig. And Stephen, just briefly as we wrap up here, how would you respond to that? He's saying 15 for a family and maybe 12 for someone else.
That could be fairly reasonable. I mean, that's in a Green Bay market area. I would presume that that's a fairly reasonable hourly rate. I think one thing, though, that has not been talked about that needs to be brought in is whether or not there are benefits associated with these wages. I would be willing to take a lower hourly wage if I knew I had a good benefits package. If I did not have a benefits package or not a very good benefits package, I'd demand a higher wage.
And we leave it there. We're out of time. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Stephen Deller, Applied Economics Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about what constitutes a living wage here in Wisconsin. You can continue the conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page.